Welcome to That Anthro Podcast, the podcast dedicated to anthropology. Together, each week, we will be learning from the experts and researchers that are researching our pasts and today's problems. My name is Gabriella Campbell, and I'll be interviewing a new guest each week to bring to you the latest and greatest in anthropology. Join me for weekly episodes, whether you're an anthropology buff or looking to learn something new. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast. Hi, listeners. Welcome back to a long-awaited episode. I feel like everyone's been missing the podcast, I know, but I'm getting out the episodes as quickly as I can, and I'm happy to say that for at the very least the next 2 months, we will consistently have episodes every 2 weeks. So there will be obviously the one that's coming out today on the 15th, and then the next episode has already been recorded, will be coming out on March 29th. So yeah, it's a great episode, as is this one. And I will say, because this episode is with Dr. Matt Velasco from Cornell University. And he mentioned in the very end of our conversation something really awesome that he's put together for the SAAs, the Society of American Archaeology meeting in Portland at the end of this month. So I have moved it to the front of the episode so that anyone who is going to the SAAs can hear it right away. I didn't want it to you to click off at the end before you could hear it. Please consider signing up for it. It sounds really great, and I will have the link in the description. I'm also going to post it on Instagram, or if you want to just send Matt an email, you can do that as well. So yeah, any updates with me? Life's good. Just trying to make it through grad school, do what I can. I'm taking Intro to Paleopathology this semester, Archaeology of Climate Change, and then my Cultural Anth Theory class, which is always a struggle, but I love my Paleopath class and my Archaeology of Climate Change class. I really look forward to going every week to them, and I hope to chat more with you guys soon, but I'm trying to get this episode out quickly because I just got back from my vacation to Williamsburg, so I'm going to keep this intro nice and short. Enjoy the episode with Dr. Velasco. He's a great person, and there's also a lot of really relevant information about applying to Cornell. If you are a student considering applying to Cornell, make sure you listen to the last half hour, because that's where we talk about his specific advice for applying there. Without further ado, let's get into the episode.
And I'll make a quick plug for student listeners who are going to mm-hmm. be SAAs. I'm a co-chair of the SAA Bioarchaeological Interest Group, and we're putting together a workshop, a power mentoring session where we've lined up a number of professionals in bioarchaeology and inside and outside of academia who will have these different mentoring stations, and we'll kind of move between them. It's kind of like that speed dating model or power mentoring.
Yeah.
I think it's called power mentoring in some context. At any rate, we have a Google Doc signup sheet, and it's gone out on Facebook, it's gone out in emails, but if somehow you've missed it and you're hearing it, send me an email at mcv47@cornell.edu. I'll send you the Google Doc signup. It's not too late. It would be great to meet in person, and it's another thing to do. The SAAs are very expensive. I know not all students can make them, but what Dr. Sarah Jungs and I are trying to do is add more value and more community into the SAA, which has also had its own troubles in the past years. And so how can we make the community that we want? Mm. And so we're trying to do that first in the BioArch interest group. So shoot me an email, and I would love to meet in person at the SAAs. I unfortunately won't be at the AABAs this year.
Okay.
I'm always happy to meet the students and in conference settings.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much. All right, listeners, welcome back to That Anthro Podcast. Today, I have Dr. Matt Velasco of Cornell University with me, and I'm really honored to have him with us because I have only heard amazing things about his work and him as a person, so it's always a pleasure to have really established scholars on the podcast. So welcome, Dr. Velasco.
Thank you. I think this is the first introduction that has stated I am an established scholar. So I much appreciated. I've hit a benchmark.
Yes, yes. So just to start our conversation, I'm curious to hear about how you were introduced to anthropology. Like, where does this journey start? And then we'll go from there.
As a high school student, I think if I had been asked, what is anthropology? I don't think I would have known the answer. I'm fairly certain that our anthropology was not in my vision of what I might study in college or what I might do with my life. I have always had an interest in the past and in ancient civilizations, not archaeology necessarily. I hadn't even seen, you know, I've only seen Indiana Jones as an adult, which is really puts me in a minority among archaeologists. So all that is to say that I think that if I look back on my life, there are certain impulses and passions I have that maybe made me suited for anthropology. And one of them was, you know, film studies and cinema. I thought I was going to apply to film school as a high school student. Wow. And if I try to make sense of that, you know, retrospectively, I was very interested in storytelling and understanding what makes people tick. And yet, I think also critiquing myself as a high school student and looking back at story treatments that my friends and I wrote, I don't know if I had very many great ideas. And I think part of it is I had a somewhat narrow vision of humanity and of the world. And when I went to Stanford, where I did my undergraduate degree, I went because, you know, it's such a prestigious university. I had an amazing visit there. They still had film studies. But I also knew there was something inside of me that told me I wasn't ready to fully commit to a career in film, knowing how daunting the job market was. Of course, I chose a field that also has a very challenging and yes, problematic job market at any rate. So, you know, I didn't go to UCLA or USC that have these established film programs. I decided, you know, I want to broaden my horizons at Stanford. And part of that was taking classes that interested me. I didn't know what my major would be freshman year. I was still shopping around sophomore year. And I took a course. I may be getting the order incorrect here, but I took a course on human origins, which I always was fascinated by. I took it with Dr. Richard Klein, who wrote, he's written The Human Career. He's kind of been an advocate of this notion of kind of a cultural and behavioral revolution around 50,000 years ago, which has fallen out of favor, I would say, in paleoanthropology. But it was very influential at the time. It was influential on me as a young student. And so that was my first anthropology class. And then I decided, maybe concurrently with that or the following semester, I took John Rick's Intro to Archaeology course. And John Rick's an Andean archaeologist. Mm. And in that course, right, so this is my first intro course. In that course, he showed a three-dimensional model animation of the subterranean passageways at Chavinda Huantar, which is a ceremonial center in the north central highlands of Peru, really fascinating site where these, you know, ritual cult activities took place. And John Rick has looked at the site with regards to what it can tell us about the evolution of power and authority. For me, right, it was just an incredible sight to behold, this three-dimensional model. And then he let the class know, I'm taking 12 students, fully funded through an undergraduate research grant, you know, you have to apply. And I was kind of had a one-track mind at that point, which this, I want to do this. I did well in the course, I applied, and then I was able, you know, able to go to Peru. Before I get to Peru though, right, I take the archaeology class and I think, okay, I really like this intro course. I want to see if I'm cut out for this major. Let me take an advanced course. Mm. So Stanford is trimesters. And so winter, I think I take archaeology in the fall of my sophomore year. Winter of my sophomore year, so January, February, March, I take human osteology. Right? That is the point. I mean, you know, I don't remember much of my, I look back at college and this sounds like I'm a partier or something. This is not what I mean. I look back at college and I remember the extracurriculars, friendships made, things that happened beyond the proverbial walls of Stanford, going to Peru, et cetera. But osteology is a class I remember in great detail because it was an obsession. I remember going for walks in the mornings with my advisor, and we had this advising group with an advisor and some friends. And I'd be looking at twigs on the ground and I'd see the shape of a clavicle or the shape of a rib. And so to say that it completely consumed me is an accurate statement. And so, you know, that essentially that sophomore year at Stanford, archaeology with an Andean archaeologist, osteology with a paleoanthropologist, mm-hmm. ultimately in my career, I would go on to combine Andean archaeology and osteology or bioarchaeology more broadly. So that's kind of my origin story. It's not one, I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to make some reflection on destiny, but you know, a few things go different in my life and I'm not a bioarchaeologist. And that's just, that's a strange fact to reckon with, that I don't know if things play out slightly different. I choose a different school, I choose different courses. I really think, you know, becoming a bioarchaeologist is contingent on having taken a chance on those classes or just following an instinct that, mm-hmm. you know, imagine what if John Rick had been on sabbatical yeah. my sophomore year, you know? I mean, yeah. It's such a strange thing to tell yeah. students today that, right, I don't think, and I tell this to my advisees that, you know, it's not some, you were not trying to unlock a destiny. Like you have these passions and interests, but so much of life is contingencies and choices, right? And so much is also the conditions in which we make those choices and which those yeah. contingencies play out. But yeah, I don't know what to make of that. That I would not be a bioarchaeologist were it not for some very key interventions in my academic life.
Yeah, it's all about right place, right time. And I really relate to that in my experience at UC Santa Barbara. And so now Dr. Anderson, but at the time she was a PhD student, Amy Anderson.
Great, yeah.
Yes.
I know Amy. She studies Cobra Rotalia.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Amy is, oh my gosh, I adore Amy. I am so thankful. And Amy is my reason for the way my path went the way it went. And so osteology hadn't been offered at UCSB for, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years. And then my second semester of my, quarter, now I'm on semester system, so I always forget and I swap them up. Right. Winter quarter, it was being offered. So I'd only just taken like one intro to archaeology class, but I had came into UCSB, declared major, knew I wanted to do anthropology, knew I wanted to do osteology. At the time, I thought forensic anthropology. And I went to the advisor and I was like, how do I get into this class? And she was like, it is an upper division class. There is no way you're getting in. And I was like, okay, but how do I get into this class? And the advisor was like, I'll give you Amy's email and we'll see. And at that point, I was so serious that I'd already signed up for a field school. So I sent Amy an email, explained my interest, explained that I was going to a field school. And by some grace, she responded back and said, okay, you can be in the class. So after one semester, similar to you, you know, thrown right into the fire of osteology. And it was, I feel the exact same way. It's an obsession. And I think those of us that are bones minded, it's like for me, it felt like I already knew it and I was like relearning it. Like it was already programmed into my head. And then after that, I ended up going on to work with Amy on her dissertation project, which I'm very thankful for. But yeah, I think osteology, not only is it a challenge, you know, to learn all the bones, to side the bones, but it's a challenge to, if you're really passionate about this, you will love that class no matter how hard it is. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you had that experience, yeah, like I did and so many others in our field, where even though it's one of the harder classes that you take, it's something that's a lasting memory. And it's really, yeah, cool to hear that from you.
Yeah, I think, I don't know how at Lab Access worked at UCSB at the time. At Stanford, we had a kind of a key card and code access, so we could access the osteology lab at any hour to study. And I suppose this will be the first time I say so publicly. I mean, I remember falling asleep on one of the couches in the Stanford Archaeology Center after pulling an all-nighter in the lab, which I'm not endorsing that for listeners. That maybe says more about my work habits as an undergraduate than about what is necessary to succeed in osteology.
Yeah.
But all that is to say, like, it's, you know, all the stress of osteology, and it's a very stressful class because it's so much information. It's so fast paced and rigorous. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, I loved it. And I feel that about academia in general, not to get ahead of our conversation.
No, that's fine.
There is a lot of things about academia that are undesirable and need to be changed. And the one thing that is, I think, a requirement to find some measure of happiness in the academy is to absolutely love what you're doing.
Yeah.
And it's a privilege to be able to love it, and then to be able to find the support needed to pursue that passion.
For sure.
And yeah, I mean, I'm very grateful that I had, you know, support, beginning with, you know, John Rick at Stanford, mm-hmm, and through my graduate career, and even now as a junior faculty member.
Yeah. So before we get on to grad school, you mentioned three California schools. So I'm wondering, are you a California native?
Oh yeah. I'm from Southern California. Okay. LA County, San Gabriel Valley.
Okay.
The city's called San Gabriel, and it's near Pasadena. So I live in central New York now, and I'll never be a natural with four seasons. I mean, I've learned a lot. There are actually things I really appreciate about living in a place with four seasons, mm-hmm, with a winter. I should just be more explicit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm thoroughly a Californian.
Yes. So I spent half of my younger years in Santa Barbara, and then I moved to Ventura, and then back to Santa Barbara for undergrad. So I am as well. And I'm now in Virginia, which, thank goodness, is a much milder winter, especially this year. We had a very mild winter, but now it's starting to spring. And it's been so fun. I love the seasons. So actually, before we go to grad school, I want to talk about that first field experience at Chavín de Hontar, because, wow, I mean, that's like one of the legendary Peruvian sites, and to get to have your first field experience be there. I'm really curious to hear about, like, let's start with like your impressions of Peru, and then we can talk about like the field work side.
Yeah, it's difficult to put myself back into that, mm-hmm, that period of my life where I didn't know Peru. I mean, after that season, I would go on to travel to Peru almost every year for the next decade. And I loved everything about that season. It was my first time outside of the United States.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So first international trip. Living with the project team and just being within the kind of day-to-day grind of field work was exciting. It was a project where it really felt like you were being plugged into a research program, and not in any way were there buried, you know, it wasn't really run as a field school with a curriculum where it felt like I was getting a light, like an archaeology light version. Mm-hmm. It just felt like a continuation of the previous season, and you were immediately plugged in. My very first day or week in the field, a close friend at Stanford undergrad who knew I was going got me this sort of Indiana Jones hat from REI. Yeah. And I was wearing flannel.
Ooh.
Anyone who knows John Rick knows he wears flannel and Birkenstocks and khakis. And so I was wearing flannel. I had this hat on and I was holding a Stadia rod to do some total station mapping in the main faucet chavine. And it may have been one of the Peruvian archaeologists, or it may have been even a local in Chavin who was working on the project, who started calling me, you know, John Rick, like Mini John Rick. I was dressed up as him. So that kind of became a running joke. And I just think it was absolutely fun. It was absolutely serious and rigorous as an academic enterprise. And it was, you know, we were thoroughly embedded in the local community. And I think I acquired an understanding of how archaeology works and the often difficult politics and negotiations that happen behind the scenes. And I think it was maybe an introduction, you know, now that I reflect on it, that archaeology does not, you know, we talk about community engagements and this idea of a community that exists as this kind of coherent, complete, singular or monolithic entity. Mm-hmm. I realized in that first season that doesn't exist. I mean, we had a lot of community buy-in and community support, and the project had been there was well established at that point. But I remember there were really, you know, difficulties that, you know, to his credit, I don't think John Rick tried to sanitize. I mean, I think it was very, you know, it was a transparent introduction into the potentials and challenges of archaeology, especially in highland communities in Peru, where there's a history of marginalization, isolation, and other kind of long-term historical conditions that can create, intentionally or not, tensions between an outside archaeological team and local governments or organizations.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll get into this, and I think probably some people listening know, but you've continued to work in Peru. And I mean, I can imagine that was formative for when you were developing your own research projects, because I know through knowing people that work in Peru that, you know, it is one of the, it is quite a relationship that you have to build with not only the government, but the community and the different parts of the community. And like, I know with the political unsettlement right now, I don't know the details, but I know like Dr. Klaus has been talking a lot about like having to redevelop new relationships with new ministers of culture and things like that. So you're right. I feel like having that transparency in your first field project must have like prepared you in a way for the things you'd have to deal with later.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the central or key contradictions or challenges of archaeology in Peru, especially in light of a greater push in archaeology for community engaged research, mm-hmm. is that the authority and decision making on archaeological projects is vested with the national government. And mm-hmm. so this is, you know, it's a strange position that researchers find themselves in, because you need buy-in from a community, you need support, regardless of what the law is. Mm-hmm. And yet there are no legal structures in place for how communities mm-hmm. are consulted and how mm-hmm. Their approval is secured and who grants that approval or how consensuses are reached with communities. So the ethical guidelines or the pathways that any one researcher walks are multiple and varied. And maybe that's true for all archaeological research, but I think the onus, right, is on suppose on practitioners of archaeology to have these conversations and develop ethical guidelines for carrying out community engaged work, especially in the absence of legal guidelines, mm-hmm. really, or in a framework, I should say, where divisions between the Centerpol, Lima, and Urban, mm-hmm. you know, the kind of the point of gravity in Peruvian politics, and the highlands, which are, you know, historically fraught, these urban-rural dynamics in Peru. As a researcher, you're thrust into a situation, or you find yourself in a situation where your work can inadvertently exacerbate tensions mm. that are already felt between local governments or local communities and the national government, because mm. the national government, or the Ministry of Culture in this sense, is the one who approves your research. And so there's, yeah. Other than to say that it requires sustained engagement with the community, right, long before the trowel hits the ground. It's very difficult, you know, even advising students on how you go about developing these relationships. It requires time to build trust. Mm-hmm. There's no shortcut to build trust in the field.
Yeah, no, there's not. I am glad though that your students have you to help them as much as you can. On the topic of assisting graduate students, let's talk about your PhD experience at Vanderbilt. How did you select that school?
Right. Well, so I mentioned with Stanford, I had these, you know, two passions in Andean archaeology and in osteology or bioarchaeology. And there was, you know, the decision I faced as a Stanford undergraduate was, do I want to pivot toward paleoanthropology? So the mm-hmm. year after Chavin, I also did a paleoanthropology field school in the southwest of France.
Wow.
A Neanderthal site, very cool, very different kind of archaeology.
Yeah.
While I was also pursuing an undergraduate thesis at Chavin. Okay, so I had these two, right, one more maybe scientifically or archaeological science focused, and one really firmly committed to a place and a people in the Andes, like places and peoples in the Andes. And that ultimately held sway. I think, you know, there's a lot I like about paleoanthropology, but ultimately I found myself more compelled by research questions that were firmly embedded in kind of a detailed and rich cultural and social context, to be diplomatic about it. So I looked for fields, you know, I looked for graduate programs that could fulfill Andes and could fulfill, you know, bioarchaeology. And you know, there are a number of programs that fit that bill. UCSB was one of them, right, at the time. Mm. Phil Walker, who sadly passed away just a few years after, mm-hmm. a couple of years or 1 year after I had visited his lab and learned more about his research program. Phil Walker was at UCSB, so was Katharina Schreiber. That was one of, you know, a program I very, very nearly attended. It was a very difficult decision. And then Vanderbilt is unique in that it's all Latin American anthropologists or anthropologists working in Latin America. And then Tiffany Tung was there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Tom Dillahay was there. I think he's emeritus now. And his work on the peopling of the Americas was one of, you know, one of the case studies I remember learning in a couple different classes in my undergraduate career. And I think I read his whole book actually too, as an undergraduate, that was really eye-opening and drew me into the discipline, right? Mm-hmm. The debates around the peopling of the Americas. I even visited Monteverde when I did an overseas study student in Chile. We took this excursion to the kind of middle excursion south from Santiago, and we were able to visit Monteverde, which you wouldn't know it's an archaeological site if you were visiting without some context and so on. But at any rate, so Vanderbilt kind of hit those two criteria to apply, right? I only applied to programs where I could do both osteology or archaeological science and Andes. And then when I visited, Vanderbilt, it was just so impressive. I was so impressed by Tiffany Tung and her mm-hmm. research program. And I just remember, you know, moving across, it was like a whirlwind, like Tiffany was taking me to her lab, to another lab in the med school that she was collaborating with on a DNA project. And she was just so impressive as a potential advisor. And that the promise of that meeting was fulfilled in my graduate career. And I have nothing but positive things to say about working with Tiffany Tung. She was just an incredible advisor, so deeply invested in her students. Really a model I try to emulate in my own advising now. But yeah, I have nothing but positive things to say. And I think looking back at, you know, at Vanderbilt, there, so it's unique now. I'm in a program where I'm the only, you know, one of two Latin American archaeologists or archaeologists who work in Latin America. Historically, Andean studies were huge at Cornell, but they've diminished, and they diminished over the past, you know, couple decades. And so it's strange in a way to go from a lab group and a graduate cohort that was all Andes to being, you know, essentially the only Andeanist in anthropology with a few other colleagues across the College of Arts and Sciences. At any rate, looking back at, I'm going off on a tangent, looking back at Vanderbilt, right? Being in that environment, I think, enriched my work in two ways. Like, one, it was deeply, deeply engaged with a place and a region, and with disciplinary specific questions that are of concern to Andean archaeologists and anthropologists. But it also was a four-field department. I took a lot of courses with Beth Conklin, Leslie Gill. I even took linguistics course, so I can actually say I took, you know, had a four-field training in graduate school. And when I was on the job market, when I was looking for what the next step would be after Vanderbilt, I didn't realize it at the time, but I had the language and the disciplinary training to speak, to converse freely with cultural anthropologists and with archaeologists and with bioanthropologists alike. And I don't know, that's not always, that's difficult to have that broad-based training in some graduate programs if you specialize, intensely early on, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think all anthropology graduate programs usually have some requirement to take courses outside of your subdisciplinary specialization, but not always.
I have to take cultural anthropological theory, which is,
and I think, it can be like, I think often cultural anthropologists and archaeologists, and especially bioanthropologists, are often speaking on different kind of different wavelengths. And we're unique, unlike many other countries, the European tradition, Latin American tradition, that has a strict delineation in some places, shouldn't overgeneralize, but in Latin America for sure, in Peru, none of the archaeology students I work with would ever think of themselves as anthropologists.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, the United States, and you can look at departments where you see stronger divisions between archaeology and sociocultural wings of the discipline. At a place like Cornell, our department is thoroughly integrated. We're almost more organized around themes and research interests than around subdisciplinary or disciplinary specialization. And I think my training at Vanderbilt made me, you know, well prepared to be a colleague and an anthropologist at a place like Cornell. And I do, you know, I guess I, at the same time, I miss having, you know, there would be other benefits to being at a place where there were more biological anthropologists, or there was a stronger tradition or colleagues engaged with Andean archaeology specifically. I do sometimes miss that, but I also think, you know, especially for bioarchaeology, we need to do better at speaking beyond our discipline. And I hope, you know, I hope to be able to do that one day. And I think being in a department where you are always translating your work to a broader audience, even if it is still an academic audience, is good practice.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's definitely an important point. And just like generally, in a situation like a podcast or an interview or any sort of public outreach you're doing, you're kind of already being trained for that in your meetings with your colleagues. And I think that that's super important because, I mean, part of the reason I have the podcast is because I believe that we need to be able to translate our work to a more public audience. Though my podcast has more of like a niche students who are anthropology nerds following, but I love my listeners. It's fine. Like that's it's found the audience that it needed to find, and that's what matters. So,
I think that's great. I mean, having a broader sense of community and anthropology that goes beyond your institution. Or your cohort, if you're a graduate student. That's really cool.
Yeah. Actually, that reminds me, I was going to speak your cohort and kind of like the years before and after you. You know, Vanderbilt's produced a lot of really great students and scholars, and it's very interesting. Like your generation has, like, there's a lot of people that I'll be like, oh, they got their PhD at Vanderbilt, or they have some like connection. They worked with someone, you know, they worked with Tiffany or they worked with someone. So that's pretty interesting. Okay, so let's talk about Cornell then. Sure. So when did you start at Cornell?
See, I started fall of 2016. I was a postdoc for 1 year. Okay. And then I started on the tenure track in 2017. So I've been here now. Yeah, do the math.
You had a sandwich before the pandemic, and then you dealt with the pandemic, and now you've had some time after. But I think that's good because I was just talking to Dr. Ayanna Fluellen, and they came right at the beginning of the pandemic. And I'm like, that is just such a hard time to start as a professor because you're trying to develop your pedagogy. You're trying to develop how you advise, even if it's just like an undergrad, you know, and that was just like such a tough time. So I think probably that was a good thing for you.
Totally. I mean, I have colleagues who also started during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Two that were hired, I think, started fall 2020 or fall 2021. At any rate, it was so important for my professionalization. Mm-hmm. In a place with, you know, with my new colleagues, attending faculty meetings in person, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I could go on and on. And I, you know, I know I have colleagues here and elsewhere where they weren't afforded that possibility. I mean, it was impossible under the conditions of the lockdown. So yeah, absolutely. And mm-hmm. I think in my case, what was maybe one of the most challenging things for me, I will say, I mean, I think the pandemic came in some ways, right, at a point where I was positioned, pivoting more toward publication of previous research. Mm. So it was, I mean, I don't want to use the word easy in the pandemic in the same breath. Yeah. I mean, the pandemic was very difficult for me in other ways. You know, but I guess my field plans were interrupted. Let me say, so, you know, I still don't think I've quite, made sense of how the pandemic has impacted me. I will say that I had a cohort of students, excellent undergraduates, who had gone with me to Peru in 2018, who were doing independent research in my lab, and they graduated, many of them graduated spring 2020. Mm. And I had taught osteology in 2019, and then I'm only teaching it again now in 2023.
Wow.
There's been, in a way, a large gap in my training of students and really being able to get students plugged into my research program in Peru. So between the pandemic and field work being stalled, mm-hmm. In my personal life, you know, my partner and I just had a kid. So last summer, I couldn't go to Peru. This summer, because of personal reasons, I won't be able to go to Peru, but also because of the very, you know, ongoing political crisis there. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say if, you know, in what ways research might be viable.
Yeah.
If it's advisable from an ethical, legal, or personal safety standpoint.
Yeah.
That is still very much, you know, unresolved. And it's
definitely
a really difficult situation to correspond with my friends and colleagues mm-hmm. through in this. I mean, there's all these other factors that personal, professional, geopolitical mm-hmm. that will influence the next stage of my research. But in many ways, I had something of a population crash in my lab and a long hiatus of really having like multiple students at different levels, right, of the of the research process, from data collection to data analysis to presentation of results at conferences and everything. So I almost feel like, you know, to use a sports metaphor, I'm in a rebuilding year.
Okay.
Where I'm trying to draw more students into my research.
Yeah.
And find ways that they can, you know, use legacy data sets or unanalyzed data sets from previous field season to start getting experience in original research, which is, I think, the most important thing for an undergraduate who's interested in a career in, or a next step in anthropology, whether it might be a research program, PhD, et cetera. Getting experience in research, in taking a research, realizing research from the point of articulating a question to analyzing data, to presenting and communicating those results is invaluable. And as an advisor, it kind of falls to me to help create those opportunities. And I think the hardest part professionally in the pandemic was not being able to create those opportunities for students, in part because of the long hiatus in my field research program, right? I want to emphasize, I think that the pandemic is still ongoing.
Yes.
I mean, it affected many people. It affected me personally. And I don't, you know, in no way I'm suggesting that this is a calculation of, you know, career and public health crisis. Like, it's so much more than that. So I'm in a very narrow sense about advising
students. Yeah, I mean, I was a student who lived through that and experienced that. And actually, I had the pleasure to work in Phil Walker's former lab and be a part of research projects regarding bioarchaeology at UCSB. But yeah, it was a tough time, and definitely I think a rebuilding for a lot of programs. And I think that's why the 2021, 2022 grad application cycle was, I'm going to be honest, disappointing for a lot of people that I know, because there was like that delay of people not applying, programs not offering like funding for certain, for those years, for like 2020, 2021. I think a lot of people, you know, applied to PhD programs in the end of 2021, like for the starting 2021. I'm like, what year are we even in? I can't even remember. And, you know, there was just too much talent and not enough spots, you know, and I think you probably like lived through that. So yeah, I know now, like this year, I've had a lot of friends get into the PhD programs they want, which just warms my heart to know,
it's being on the other side of graduate admissions. Like you said, too much talent, not enough spots, like completely. Yeah. I mean, it's very, our program, the cohort size has diminished since the start of the pandemic. It's not exclusively a consequence of the pandemic. Part of it is changing policies at our graduate school, but it's not unrelated to the pandemic. And, you know, we're a faculty of 20 to 20, what are we, over 20, I think somewhere around 24, okay? And we admit a cohort of around 5 students, and maybe one or two are archaeologists. And so it's always very difficult where, you know, we get these excellent applications and we're looking to build a cohort where we have, you know, diverse strengths, and admitting students that are not dependent on one advisor is really important in our program. So when it's a student doing exclusively bioarchaeology and not articulating their bioarchaeological work to broader anthropological concerns, it's a little harder on our end to think about, okay, who is this student? How will we compose, or how will this student compose a committee beyond right this one faculty member? And so it's really, you know, I always get emails, and I'm happy to, you know, to respond to them, like, are you accepting students? And the one thing I always tell students is, I don't accept anyone, right? It's not, there's other programs, I think, that have a more lab-based model where a professor has agency to turn on the spigot and bring in more students, or turn off as well. And it's such a collaborative and team exercise in our admissions that no one faculty priority, no one faculty member is prioritized in the process. And so the advice I give to students applying to our program specifically is, remember your audience is all the faculty members,
okay.
specifically, you know, cultural anthropologists and archaeologists. And so that all goes back to what I was saying about, you know, having been raised in a four-field department, that and being able to speak across subdisciplinary boundaries is important. It's an important part of your graduate training. And for better or worse, it's almost a prerequisite for applying to graduate school in our department as well, just given the makeup and its intellectual commitments and the kind of program we run. So
I think that's important to touch on. I'm glad that we got to touch on that, because we do have a lot of students that are, whether now or in the next 3 or 4 years, considering graduate school. I think that's really important to remember that every department is going to be different. And yeah, there are some departments where it is the professor takes a certain amount of students. Like, I know that for a fact from not only my own application process, but from UCSB. So it's good to know how different programs are. I think Columbia is like that as well, because one of my roommates was just applying there, and from talks with Temple, I think that they're kind of like they want a more like general anthropological people, but I could be wrong.
Let me give some frank advice to your listeners too.
Please.
And actually, I look back on my graduate, my personal statement and statement of purpose, and I think it was solid, but it was also very vague in terms of what I wanted to do in graduate school, right? Beyond, I want to continue in Andean biology, I want to specialize. I think the graduate application process has become so much more competitive in the past, you know, decade and a half, that there's almost an expectation or a need for students applying to very selective programs to have identified a potential topic before they apply. That is very, very difficult. And so my advice to students is, okay, you need to don't think about it as identifying a topic, because that's almost impossible. You don't know where exactly you'll be able to work, et cetera.
Yeah.
Change. I mean, I didn't know my graduate project when I was applying to Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
Right? I discovered it and I developed it over the first few years of my time there. Okay, but things have changed. And so—
Yes, they have. And I'm not sure it's for the better.
Right. Like, you need to be able to demonstrate that you can think of a question and how to address it, right? Even if you're not sure where you'll address it, like you have an interest in you know, some aspect of bioarchaeology or the dynamics of state formation and their impacts on marginalized populations, or we could go on and on thinking of hypotheticals, and try to articulate a question of broad interest and outline an agenda or a way you will go about addressing it, like and essentially to model your thinking in research design. Now, we don't expect students to come in having every detail polished. That's unrealistic. And part of our job in graduate school is to give students the tools and the knowledge to refine their research questions and their research design. But in our program, for example, which is, like I said, very competitive, if we're only accepting 5 students for a faculty of over, you know, of nearly 24, it's not enough to say, I want to continue studying what I'm studying now, right?
Yeah.
You have to show some degree of creativity or some kind of, you're signaling what's next. And that's, I'm saying it's very hard to do that. It is a high degree of difficulty. I'm also admitting to all your listeners, I did not do that as an undergraduate applying a graduate program. And I just think part of it is that the field has become more competitive in graduate applications. So I mean, so that's my really frank advice. So if you're doing undergraduate research or you're doing master's research, I would say, based on the results of those research, you know, either you know, propose a distinct, like try to propose a distinct follow-up to your existing research might be the easiest way. That goes beyond saying, I will collect more samples, but my research generated this finding, but we still don't understand this. And so I will expand in this direction.
Got it.
It doesn't, I mean, I also should say that applications are evaluated holistically, and it's not just about, right? part of it is about your personal and intellectual commitments, narrating your personal history and how it fits into anthropology, especially if you have a maybe a non-traditional path into the field, is really important. And we think holistically about students, and it's not just some, we're not evaluating it like we do a grant proposal.
Yes.
Nonetheless, like, I do think the bar has risen in terms
it has.
Of what students are expected to demonstrate in a personal statement or statement of purpose.
Yeah. And also a research background and from my and my friends' experiences, I know very few people who have been able to go straight from undergrad to a PhD program.
Yeah.
Very, very few. And so seeing it with my friends, I kind of knew I wanted to go straight to the MA, but then having Amy Anderson with the best of intentions being like, wait, well, you mean now it's expected to get an MA first? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, but I was applying not that long ago. And I'm like, Amy, it's changed. It's changed a lot. And I think, like we were saying earlier, it's not necessarily a function of the admissions committees wanting it to change. It's that function of there is so much talent and so few spots.
And I think it's not so much that I review an application and ask, do they have an MA? But students who do have an MA are more likely to be able to fulfill the expectation of generating a research question, or they're more likely to have a product from existing research,
mm-hmm.
i.e. their master's thesis. So it's really...
Some programs actually require an MA now for a PhD program.
Really? Oh, interesting.
Which Danielle and Amy, when I told them that, their jaws almost hit the floor. And I was like, because that was for some forensic anth programs when I was originally looking at forensic anth. And both of them were like, especially Danielle was like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? Yeah. And I was just like, yeah, no, things have changed. But I'm glad that we got to chat about that. I think it's important. But I also do want to spend the remaining amount of our time talking about, your current research projects and what you're doing right now as a researcher. So could you kind of describe the goals and temporal scope of one of your ongoing projects in Peru right now?
Yeah. So my research thus far has been centered in this pre-Inca period in Andean history, known as the late intermediate period, which is quite literally sandwiched between a time of state dominance on the part of the Wari and Tiwanaku states in what's known as the Middle Horizon, so around 600 to 1000 AD, and then between that period of state formation and then the Inca state or empire around mid 15th century to the time of Spanish colonial period. And so, this late intermediate period in a nutshell is by definition a time of political fragmentation, at least in the highlands. It's a period of climate change, period of intense violence, and this has been shown empirically with cranial trauma rates. There's a really a great meta-analysis that was done by Tiffany Tung and Elizabeth Arkush looking at proxies for violence throughout history in the Andean region, and you see trauma rates peak in the LIP. Not to mention there's evidence of extensive defensive fortification across different landscapes in the highlands. Okay, so I'm situated in this period and initially was interested in how mortuary practices and treatment of the dead intervened in the politics of the living, right? In these, to fall back on some old language, kind of smaller scale societies and polities that emerge in the wake of Tiwanaku and Wari collapse in the Middle Horizon. To make a long story short, right, my dissertation in many ways is still about mortuary practices and how, related to politics in the late intermediate period. But what I found in my dissertation, or arguably the most interesting results, were what were going on with people's bodies and their lived experiences, and the ways that behind the facade of these new mortuary traditions, which involved the burial of individuals in above ground sepulchres, we see really interesting things happening with the way that social identities are expressed on the body over time among groups of people who are using or accessing these mortuary monuments. And so I published in Current Anthropology in 2018, one of the key findings from my dissertation, and now really, I suppose, the, you know, the article that presages some of the interest in my book on ethnogenesis in the late intermediate period. And you see around 1300, right, samples of skeletal remains prior to 1300 AD and after, you see a sharp uptick in the proportion of individuals who are modified, who have cranial modification, which is a practice that must be performed on an infant when the cranial bones are still malleable before the skull has fused together. Mm-hmm. And so you see this uptick in cranial modification, which suggests that forms of ethnic identity or forms of collective identity are consolidating in the region. You know, to put it kind of colloquially, like cranial modification or head binding practices rise in popularity. And the next phase of my research, in a sense, has been, well, what does that mean for those who are modified and for those who do not have cranial modification? Mm. Even in the later period, there's still moderate proportions of the burial population who have a rounded, unmodified skull. And, you know, that to make a long story short, it is the focus of my book project. So whereas my dissertation was really focused on questions of mortuary theory and social organization, my book project is really interested in a kind of fine-grained contextual analysis of head-shaping practices in the Kolka Valley and what it meant to be modified for those who had elongated heads. What did it mean to have this, you know, embodied emblem of an identity or a social role on the body as you were growing up as a child into adulthood, right? What did what were the downstream consequences of this act that was performed on children? And the area where I'm working is really interesting to address, you know, to carry out a fine-grained analysis of cranial modification, because it's one of the few, probably perhaps the only region in Peru where we have an indigenous rationale for head shaping that is recorded in the Spanish colonial documents. In 1586, a Spanish colonial magistrate is carrying out an inquest of peoples in the Coyahuas province in the south central Andean highlands. And they ask these people, right, where are you from? Or, you know, essentially, where are you from? And they say, paraphrasing here, obviously, we're from the volcano Coyaguata, right? That's where we derive our name Coyaguas, and it's from this volcano that we emerged and we descended into the Kolka Valley, displaced the native inhabitants here, and this is how we came to be in the Kolka Valley. And they say, in remembrance of the volcano from which we came, we modify the skulls of our infants thusly. So it is a way of kind of elongate, you know, the skull is an emblem, one could say, you know, or a symbol of the mountain from which the Coyahuas came. Now, for Andeanist listeners will know, mountains and bodies is a very charged analogy in the Andes, right? Mm-hmm. It taps into a lot of kind of ethnographic and historic literature on identity and place in the Andes. And if you engage with ethnography and you engage with other sources of Andean cosmology and thought, to be somewhat, you know, general, the one could suggest that to modify the head of an infant in the form of a mountain was not merely to symbolize the mountain, but to actually imbue in that child the substance of the mountain, mm-hmm. that they actually share in being with the mountain. And there's also ethnographic accounts that show this the mountains occupying a certain realm that is wild and pre-social, that infants also are at this boundary between pre-social and social. And so my book is really interested in taking the kind of ethnography and anthropology of the Andes seriously, specifically how indigenous peoples narrate their own identities and relationships to place, and thinking in relation to bioarchaeological evidence.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the broad theoretical project of the book. in a more, you know, kind of a, another way to describe it is also to think about the community dynamics of cranial modification. So many scholars have written about cranial modification as a marker of ethnic identity. Arguably, the Koyawa are also saying something to that effect to the Spanish colonial magistrate. Right? We modify our heads in this way. This is part of our identity, and so on. But I think that maybe there's been an overemphasis in scholarship on cranial modification on the us-them dynamic, right? How an elongated skull would have been viewed by an ethnic other. Whereas, what does it mean in the Colca Valley, where we have modified and unmodified individuals in the same tombs? Perhaps it represents an extended family or household or kinship group. How might the decision to modify or not modify an individual articulate with other kinship norms within a community? Can we think about kinship groups as comprising both modified and unmodified individuals? And what are the implications for how we understand this practice at a local level, so to speak? My findings also show really interesting differences in lived experiences between modified and unmodified individuals and among modified individuals, which is to say, those with the same head shape don't act necessarily have the same indicators of lived experience. We actually see greater dietary heterogeneity among modified children than among unmodified individuals.
Interesting.
It's not the case that modification, in a sense, yes, it may be conferring some sort of identity, but it's not necessarily cultivating a
status.
A status or a kind of identity that is reinforced by shared food weight, for example, right?
Yeah.
There's work, really great work in the kind of Ilo Moquegua Valley by Nene Lazada and a huge team. I mean, many other bioarchaeologists have worked on the Chidibaya. And you see this broad correlation, right, between fisher folk and farmers in the region. And that also kind of maps onto other ethnic and material cultural differences and dietary differences. And in the Colca Valley, or at least at a finer scale of analysis, it's not the case that, you know, modified individuals ate one thing and unmodified individuals tended to eat something else. It's actually that modified individuals as a group have more diversity. So why do we see greater diversity among individuals that have this shared signifier, right? What produces diversity within a community? And so, you know, in some sense, like, you know, one could say, well, you know, my research is very narrowly focused on one cemetery and one group of people, right, in the past. And so it's difficult to generalize generalize what cranial modification meant in the Andes. And to that, I would say that's not my project, right? I actually think cranial modification means one thing or needed to mean one thing, right?
Yeah.
Cranial modification is a form of material, in some sense, material culture production, just like pottery making, right? Just like a potter might mold a potter and encode certain social values in that pot, right? Someone can mold the head of their child, and the reasons for doing that in approximate sense may not necessarily be to signal us versus them. It might be to protect my child or to help my child, right, become a fully fledged human being, right?
Yeah.
A bit reductive there. So all that is to say, like, how can we think more complexly about the local level dynamics of cranial modification? And the Colca Valley is a great place to do it because we have so much ethnohistorical and archaeological research that can be read in relation with the bioarchaeological data, right?
Yeah.
Especially, right, this document that I allude to about heads being shaped as mountains, I mean, is a view that is very likely articulated by direct descendants of the people I'm studying, right? And so, you know, thinking generationally about, you know, across, you know, the pre-Inca period, the Inca conquest, and the Spanish colonial period, what are the ways where the meaning of cranial modification may also transform with these dramatic social and political changes?
Yeah. Is there any ADNA work going on?
Yes, I don't think it'll be in the book. So one of the things I'm collaborating with Dr. Lars Fehrenschmidt at UC Santa Cruz, And so one of the things I'm really interested in is, right, I have this idea or hypothesis that closely related individuals might include modified and unmodified individuals. Mm-hmm. And this is in part based, so the biodistance research I've done shows that individuals buried together appear to be more phenotypically similar than those buried apart. And that's after accounting for possible correlations between cranial modification and cranial non-metric traits for those who are into, who know the details of biodistance analysis. So regardless of whether individuals are biologically related, they are socially related by virtue of their kin or, you know, their kin, social or biosocial or otherwise, deciding to bury them in these above ground sepulchers, right? Nonetheless, I'm interested in if we can trace direct biological relationships between first degree or second degree relatives, is it possible that we can perhaps infer, you know, rules in which rules of inheritance or norms of inheritance that might have conditioned why some children were modified and others weren't, right? Is it the case that maybe, right? I don't know. So, so it's not that I want to prove that being modified, right, is somehow tied to a direct genetic relationship, but rather I want to be able to compare genetic relationships to other social and kinship relationships that are embodied through cranial modification and through the treatment of the dead, and think about the disjunctures between those line of evidence, because I don't anticipate they will line up.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. And I look forward to hearing more about, you know, that book as it materializes. I think the last question that I have for you is one that I like to ask all of my guests, because I like to paint a picture of you as a person outside of your work. So what are some of your passions outside of anthropology, outside of work? What is your, you know, your activities that bring you the most joy, or even just like reading, you know, some people it's, you know, a certain genre of book. So what, you know, take that question however you please.
Right. I think in some ways I still love television and film and cinema, and a lot of what, you know, attracted me to that field and career as a high school student still lives within me. You know, one of the things I'm most passionate about are really, like, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. That's not a secret to anyone who knows me. And so, you know, when I'm not when I'm not on the Anthro podcast, I sometimes jump on the podcast, a friend's podcast that does sports and pop culture, and I'll talk about some of the new Star Wars television series that are out. And one of my, you know, right now I'm really focused on the book and other things I need to get done for tenure, but I would really love to develop an anthropology of Star Wars course. I think there's so many aspects of Star Wars that relate to different aspects of anthropological theory, thinking about nature, culture, thinking about the cyborg, thinking about the relationship between the society and the individual, which is maybe what unifies anthropology and sociology in a very broad level. I think Star Wars engages with these things. I think George Lucas was really, was inspired by anthropology courses he took. And while I don't know if I would say Star Wars is a sophisticated meditation anthropology, I think it can be brought into conversation with anthropological theory. And that's something I kind of, that kind of criticism is something I'm doing in my head when I'm watching Star Wars. And thought of making a course about it is so exciting to me. And I have like this Word document or Evernote page that I jot down ideas for what my anthropology of Star Wars syllabus will be. So maybe within next couple years, I'll be able to do that course, and it will blend one of my hobbies, kind of blend some aspect of my nerd fandom with some aspects of my anthropology fandom. So
yeah, I'm sure the Cornell students are going to jump at that opportunity when it presents itself. That sounds really exciting. And I can't wait to tell my roommate, Mariah, about that. She did her undergrad with Tiffany at Vanderbilt. So, and now she's going on to a PhD program. Yeah. So thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your insight and just like having a great conversation with me. I really appreciate it. And I've been looking forward to this interview for quite a while. And Dr. Temple says hi.
Please give him my best. And
I will.
Dr. Klaus.
Yes.
Yeah. And Rick Smith. Right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. You guys have such a great program.
We do.
CMU. So
yeah.
What a great combination of bioarchaeologists at one place.
I feel very lucky.
The geographic scope, the theoretical scope. What a great program.
Yeah. So. And then we also have, she's newer to the department, a zoo archaeologist, Dr. Jamie Clark, who I've been taking an environmental or archaeology of climate change class with, which has been really fascinating. She works in like Subudu Cave. With like Neanderthal stuff. So yeah, I feel very, very thankful to have ended up in this place. I had some challenges in my undergrad years and some just kind of like the dynamics of UCSB weren't as collaborative as the dynamics are here at George Mason. So I am really thankful that I'm in a place where we all like respect each other in and out of the classroom.
Yeah.